Guess who's turning 50? Yep, that's right. The song Rocky Top is turning 50 years old. It was first recorded by the Osborne Brothers, and it's since been recorded by the Nitty Gritty Dirt Band, Lynn Anderson, Conway Twitty, the jam band Fish has recorded it. There are jazz versions, polka versions, reggae versions. Those are really fantastic. And of course, the Pride of the Southland Band version that you're hearing in the background. Who wrote this song and why? I'm Todd Steed, and that's what we're going to talk about here on Flipside. My guest is the son of the great American songwriters and the writers of Rocky Top, Felice and Budlow Bryant. His name is Del Bryant. He was with BMI for many, many years and has an incredible history all of his own. Del, thanks for coming in. I've got to ask you, there are hundreds of versions of this song out there. What's your favorite version?
Well, to me, many of these versions are so similar and so much the same and are very true to the song in every way that they kind of move toward a large collage of music, and I don't necessarily favor one more than the other. It is nice to pay tribute to the first version, which was the Osbournes. That without that first version, there probably would have been no other versions. But I sort of lump all of the classic bluegrass versions together. I love the marching band. It's sort of my family's chance of being John Philip Sousa. You know, they would have loved that tremendously, and they did, in fact, of course. I am very fond of a version by a gentleman by the name of Ashid, which did it in reggae, which is really uniquely different, but at the same time, there's a poignancy to it, and I guess that comes just from what reggae really is. And so it places a tremendous emphasis on the purity of the mountains. So I enjoy that one.
When people find out that your parents wrote Rocky Top, what is their reaction to the song and their memories of the song?
And when people realize that I or my brother Dane are associated with the song in any way, or that our parents more specifically wrote it, they just are somewhat in awe. They just, wow, man, you know, and it, as opposed to telling us an anecdote about it. Many of our folk songs, like A Love Hurts or A Wake Up Little Susie or A Bye Bye Love, They remember the first place they were when they heard it and what was going on in their teenage life or something of that sort. But Rocky Top, people seem to just be so amazed that it has a connection to human beings, you know, the creation of it, that they're sort of wowed and awed, and that's great. Wow. I think that so many people just feel that Rocky Top just fell out of heaven onto the University of Tennessee, and it's a... It's a very blessed and a glorious thing, and they don't really often think that it was created by songwriters. My parents would be fine with that because it kind of fell out of heaven onto them.
Maybe you can separate the fact from the myth about the genesis of the song. Here's my understanding of it. They were up in Gatlinburg writing ballads for a ballad record, and they were wanting to do something fun, and that just popped out in 10 minutes. That's my understanding. Is that true?
Well, that's basically very true. It's somewhat cut down in an abbreviated story, to say the least, but it is true. They were in Gatlinburg writing an album for Archie Campbell, one of the stalwarts and creators and writers of Hee Haw. He used to have a show place up here, and he would, you know, have his shows just like in Branson. And he had quite a audience, and it was generally a little bit older. It skewed to the older side, and he had asked the folks to write an album that would work for his primary fans that were somewhere there 50s, 60s, 70s, and so forth. And he had the title for the album. He wanted to name it Golden Years. So they went to Gatlinburg to write the album for Archie. And I must tell you that songwriters are never more honored and pleased and excited than when they get an opportunity to write a whole album for someone. I mean, that is just about as good as it gets, that someone would want you to do that. So they were very excited and very pleased to do it, and they came to Gatlinburg and sort of hid away in the Gatlinburg Inn in their favorite room that was close to the lift that carries people to the top of the mountain and back, with a little patio. Dad liked that room because he could go sit out on the patio and wave at people and say hello as they quickly were, you know, escorted by. But they were up there writing this, what Mother thought of as an old age album. And they had written and written and written more and more of those type songs. And my mother stopped in the middle of one effort and said, "Boodle, I feel like I'm just getting older by the minute myself." Said, "I feel like I've aged 20 years since we've been here. Can't we just write something up-tempo, something peppy, maybe a mountain song, bluegrass, anything? I just can't go on doing this until we do something else for a while." And Dad said, "Well, you know, this is our job. We've got an assignment. Let's finish it. We're close to the end of it. Let's just push through it and get this done, and then we'll write anything you want." And Mom said, "I just can't go on. I feel like I'm aging by the second." And Dad said, "Oh," and he grabs his guitar that was always close by and started beating out a rhythm and said, "Wish that I was on old Rocky Top down in the Tennessee hills." And he said, "How do you like that?" And she said, "I like that. Let's write that." And he said, "Really?" And she said, "Yeah." And so they wrote it in about 10 minutes. Quite often people in some sort of disbelief say, "Well, you couldn't have really written that in 10 minutes. And Dad's response to that was, we'd been writing for a week or more. We had really invoked the muse, and the muse was in the room, and everything was going rather quickly. We were in the zone. We were in that writing zone that you can get into if you really are applying yourself." And he said, "The song just fell out. It was very simple. It was very organic, and it fell out. We wrote it." He put it in the book, the ledgers that he wrote in, and forgot about it and moved on to one of those slower tempo old age songs. And that's the story, but you had it.
Aren't you glad that he didn't tell your mom, "You know, let's just go across the street and get some saltwater taffy, and that'll, you know, break the monotony"?
Yeah, there are a zillion things that could have happened that fortunately none of them happened. I guess they could have gone to the taffy shop and written the world's greatest polka song. I don't know. but it happened just the way I guess it had to happen. And the fact that it made it out of the book in itself was a miracle, because they wrote thousands of songs that are still in those books, those ledgers, that never made it out. And Dad used to say, with regard to all the songs that had never been cut, because they were, you know, they had 16 books by the time my father passed, he used to say, "Well, one day they'll make it out. They're just like wine. They're aging in the books." Well, fortunately, even though Rocky Top is now associated not because of my family, just because people have associated with moonshine and other things, it didn't have to wait till it was fermented to make it out of the books. It came out pretty quickly. And the Osborne brothers finding that song and my folks having the good sense to pitch it was just a miracle.
So you're telling me that they have an entire catalog of songs that have never been recorded?
Yes, they had about 800 unique titles recorded. Some of them, such as Rocky Top and Bye Bye Love and All I Have to Do is Dream, have been recorded hundreds of times.
Love Hurts, right?
Love Hurts also.
What a great one.
But they had approximately 800 distinctive, different titled songs recorded. But they wrote thousands of songs. And so there are quite a few songs just aging in the books, waiting to come out, you know. And from time to time, my brother and I will try and pitch a number of the old unrecorded songs because people come and they say, wow, have you got anything that was written for the Everlys that they never did? And the answer is yes. We've had people ask if there was anything written for Jimmy Dickens that he didn't do, and the answer is yes. So we pitch songs from time to time, and every now and then we get one cut. I pitched a song to John McEwen recently that hadn't been done in 60 years. And so that does happen. But unfortunately, I think every prolific writer or group of writers probably have far many more songs that weren't recorded than those that were. And they may be equally as good. It's just that there's an alchemy to this type of business, and you never can really understand it. Some make it and some don't.
You know, there's something happened with a lot of Woody Guthrie's unwritten songs. Billy Bragg and Wilco went through the family and said, hey, let's do a whole record of these unwritten songs. And they end up getting three records out of it, I think, three different records. And it's just a fabulous collection. I wonder if somewhere out there's some really smart and great musician that could go in and do the same thing and say, you know, I guarantee there's gold in those hills, you know.
Well, I'm sure that there's gold in them there hills, because a lot of the songs almost got cut. A lot of them didn't get cut. I forget who it was. I think it was, I can't remember right now, but a very famous artist who was talking about my folks and how they would pitch songs, and he would say that that people would come to the house and listen to songs, and they were just amazed that there were so many songs that they couldn't cut. They couldn't cut them all, so they would just end up walking away with a couple of them. But they wrote great songs. They completed their songs. They polished their songs. They all told a story. They all rhymed, and they were all capable of being cut. So I'm sure that if somebody felt that desire to do that, then we'd be glad to work with them. We do have from time to time, specifically now, it'll be my father's 100th anniversary, 2020. And we've had a couple of people who have come and said, we'd like to do an album of unrecorded songs. So we're sort of working with a couple of people looking at that prospect now, but not necessarily just famous people, unfortunately, but some people that are looking possibly to cut a great album and maybe get some publicity out of it. My folks were very, very staunch in their belief that any new artist was as good as any established artist. That's why people such as the Everlys, such as, Bob Lumen, such as so many that we could name that are famous now but who weren't famous when they first started cutting my folks' songs, they were anxious to get anything cut by anybody. They felt that there was no way to know where the next hit was coming from, that it was so serendipitous that their job was to get it cut, and it was the job of the universe to make it a hit, but that it wasn't necessarily going to be any more of an insurance policy for a hit if a well-known artist did it. They were glad to let new people hear their best material.
Can you speak a little bit about the working relationship between your parents? Who did what? Did someone control lyrics more or music more, or who had the final say? Was it a peaceful process? You know, how did it go?
Well, the final say generally, I'll start with that part of the question, went to my father. He was the primary polisher of the songs. I would also say that they both wrote complete songs. Mother had a number of hits by herself. Dad had quite a few more, but Mother had a song called We Could, a classic country song that's been cut by so many people, and it's been a hit several times. She had a Ricky Nelson hit called I'm Not Afraid. And actually, she really wrote Take a Message to Mary, the Everly Brother cut. It was completely written, and on the session, Archie Blyer, who produced the Everlys, said, Bootlow, there's something, I'm missing something. I think it needs something else, maybe a prelude. And Dad went out and wrote, these are the words of a frontier lad who lost his love when he turned bad. And that's all Dad wrote. But because he did write that, both their names are on the song. But Mother wrote the Take a Message to Mary and the melody and everything. So she was a complete writer. Dad did write songs such as All I Have to Do is Dream and Love Hurts and Let's Think About Living and the instrumental Mexico that inspired Herb Alpert to form the Tijuana Brass.
You're listening to Flipside. I'm Todd Steed talking with Del Bryant, the son of great American songwriters Felice and Budlow Bryant. Let's hear one of those songs. This is Love Hurts by the Everly Brothers.
Love hurts, love scars, love wounds and mars any heart not tough nor strong enough to take a lot of pain, take a lot of pain. Love is like a cloud, holds a lot of
song that was a big hit for the rock group Nazareth in the 70s. Also, Roy Orbison did a great version of it. The Everly Brothers did, I know of at least two versions of this song. There was a version on Warner Brothers that was more up-tempo, but this is my favorite. From songwriters Felice and Budlow Bryant, Love Hurts. Actually, I think that was mostly Budlow. Our guest on this evening's Flipside is Del Bryant, the son of those esteemed songwriters. And we're talking about the teamwork between Felice and Budlow Bryant.
He was more of a complete writer, but when they wrote together, quite often Mother would start a song, and Dad would just listen and then go, stop. And then he would work on it, look at his hand, his fretting hand. He was a violinist and a guitar player, but he'd been a great violinist, and he would always fret on his left hand, look at it, and he would look at that, and then he would write something in his book, and he'd look at his thing, and then he would write Mother's lyrics down. He might change a few. And he said, okay, Felice, keep going. And she said, where were we? And he'd pick the guitar up and start strumming, and she'd get back into the groove. And then she'd just extemporaneously start making up things. And Dad would say, that's it, stop. And then he'd put some of that in the book, change some of that, fret on his fingers, you know, for a while on his palm of his hands. And that was quite often one of the primary ways they worked, with her just spewing out anything and everything and Dad saying, halt, halt, and then adding something and changing something and reworking something. Quite often, if it was a song that Dad generally wrote by himself, it was written early in the morning because he got up far earlier than Mother. She tells the story of hearing Wake Up Little Susie, Dad pounding it out downstairs, and she said, damn, that sounds good. I got to get up and get on it. You know, and so she woke up and contributed heavily to that song. But quite often Dad would start a song and she would jump in on it. Quite often she had something going, a poem or a melodic idea, and he would jump on it. There was absolutely no ego involved in their relationship as to who wrote it, who started it. And if Mother wrote it by herself, no one was trying to jump on it with a word and say, oh, I'm involved. And if Dad had written it, Mom wasn't about to say, oh, I don't like it, or criticize it and say, let's add this to it. They were proud of each other's work when it was a complete work on their own. And when anyone started something, they just jumped in together. There was no big sense of ownership of anything. They just wanted to finish another one and then another one and then another one.
Did they know from a very young age that they wanted to be songwriters and musicians, or how did that path form where they went that way full time?
Well, my father, and this is the proper way to start because he was 5 years older than Mother. At the time he was five, he started taking violin lessons. There was a gentleman from Boston who had been in the symphony there, who had moved to Georgia because of his health. He was of poor health, and they said that the South would be better for his breathing and everything else. And he had moved down south, and my grandfather got him involved with my father at a very early age, teaching him violin. So Dad had a lot of training in the violin throughout his early life, and eventually became a player in the Atlanta Symphony when he was 18 years old. So he was a prodigy somewhat. So he always felt that music would be a very, very important part of his life, but not writing it, performing it. He wanted to be Heifetz. He worshipped Paganini. He was into classically playing his violin, and because he was a child of the South, he also knew what a hoedown was, and he was a state champion at 12 and 13 in Georgia, state the fiddle champion. So he could play, he said, Arkansas Traveler better than anybody he knew, and at the same time play great works of classical music. So he just wanted to be a player and a picker, and then when he got into earning a living and playing with all the sort of the cowboy bands and the flower bands, advertising flower companies, and the modern sort of swing bands, he was happy to be a player. That's what he thought he was going to be. Mother, on the other hand, born in Milwaukee to an immigrant Italian family, loved music. She loved movies. She loved songs. She lived in a somewhat of a fairy tale world of songs and singing. She fancied herself a singer. She'd been on the Major Bowles radio hour as a very, very young child, and said she remembered getting fan mail when she was damn near still in her diapers. But she was really driven toward show business. She worked in a vaudeville theater where she would escort the stars backstage and get to hang out a little bit with them. She had gone to several football games with Liberace. She was just a dear friend of his. And she was very interested in show business. And she was from a very poor neighborhood, and her friends, for the most part, were impoverished also. And ghetto Italians and Polish kids living in similar surroundings. And so when she was very young, she started writing poetry and trying to make up her own songs. And when she met Dad, she immediately recognized his musical genius. And at the point they were married, and he would go out and gig and come home at night late, she eventually started to show him. She didn't, she said, for approximately a year. She was just a little bit embarrassed. She didn't quite know what to do at home. She'd clean till the place was spick and span. Then she'd start with her poetry. And after a while, he came home one night and said, well, what have you been doing? And she said, well, I want to show you what I've been doing. I've been writing poetry. And Dad was so impressed with it and so excited by it, and he started putting melodies and cleaning it up a little in spots that he thought it needed to be improved. He was a brilliant young guy himself. He had not gone past high school, but he had studied Greek, he had studied Latin, he had a photographic memory for words, he was erudite beyond his age, and so he would look at the stuff, work with it, add melody or take the melody that she had started, annotate it down on a scrap of paper somewhere, start manipulating it around and help her finish her work into finished songs. So they started working on songs, his ideas, her ideas, and she was the woman behind the man. There is no doubt. She desired this and kept saying, "We can do this." Dad said, "Oh, that's a tough business." And after they had about 80 songs in their quiver, Mom said, "I know we've got songs as good as I've been hearing on the radio. Bootla, we've got to be able to do something with these." And they found a Billboard magazine and started writing letters to everybody who they could find an address on who had their name in the Billboard, whether they were producers or artists or our record label people. And eventually, that paid off for them.
Where did they meet? I mean, Milwaukee and Georgia are not right next to each other. That's kind of surprising they even met.
Well, my dad was an itinerant musician. He was playing all over the country. During the war years, he was one of the top jazz people. That reminds me, walking through your studios looking at all the jazz records, Dad was one of the top jazz fiddle players in Detroit and Chicago during the war. And he played, he would jam with Snuff Smith, he jammed with Krupa. He was there amongst it, and he was playing his little ass off, you know, in every little jazz club that you could imagine. And so he was playing a circuit, so to speak, and that circuit included Milwaukee, and he was with a jazz quartet playing the Schrader Hotel when he met Mother. And so she was the elevator operator. She and her sister both operated the elevators at the Schrader. It was one of their part-time jobs. They had a number of jobs during the war. And so they met there. They met at the elevator, in fact. Mother was operating the elevator. She stopped on the floor he was, excuse me, and saw him across the foyer and recognized him somehow, and she didn't know how. But he walked over to the water fountain, and she said, "Can I buy you a drink?" The water fountain was located in between the elevator doors, or the separate elevator shafts. And she stepped on the water cooler, and it splashed Dad everywhere. And she immediately was, "Oh, I'm sorry," and started drying him off. And she asked him if she could buy him a drink. And my father said, "Why, sure, I've got a break." And they went downstairs, and they had a Coke or something. I'm not sure what they had. But later that evening, from the band stand in that hotel, Dad introduced her as his fiance. And they were, as Johnny and June said in a song that wasn't written by my folks at all, but I love, they got married in a fever hotter than a pepper sprout. Shortly afterwards.
Did she know he was going to introduce her as his fiance?
I'm not sure she knew it, but she was thrilled. She says that she was struggling trying to remember where she knew him from, but it came to her that evening. She had a dream that she had spoken about throughout her life, her young life, when she was 8, about a man that she was dancing with and waltzing with. And he was tall and he was handsome, and they were dancing to their own music.
Wow.
And she told that to Dad later that night. I recognize you from my dream. You're the man that I've dreamt of. And strangely enough, my father had been to a soothsayer in his youth. I say that with a lot of reverence for soothsayers. I'm just clairvoyant. Who had told him that he would meet a lady that he would work with and that they would create something. He wasn't sure what they were going to create, but that would make them very wealthy and somewhat famous. So they both had harbingers of each other in their youth. But that was how they met. And the only thing that Dad wasn't sporting that Mother had seen in her dream was a beard. And it was upon my mother's insistence that Dad grew his goatee shortly afterwards and, with a few exceptions, kept it for the rest of his life.
You've been listening to Flipside. We've been talking with Del Bryant, the son of Felice and Budlow Bryant. I'm Todd Steed. Thanks for listening.